Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome back to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I was away, vacation. You know, everybody needs a little vacation, so I took a little break. But I'm back, and Happy New Year to everyone. Happy holidays post to everyone. I hope you guys had a good time during the holidays. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. I'm not on TikTok yet. It's pulling me, but I'm not there yet. You can also email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I would love to hear from you. And you can donate on PayPal, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Did I say that again? Saturdays with Joy Keys. Yes, that's the running theme right there. But this morning, wow, she was telling me she was excited to be on my show, and I was telling her I was excited to have her. You know, when I have people on the show that interview people, I'm like a little nervous, you know. It's different than people who don't interview. Not that they're less than, but these people that interview people, they are constantly thinking about questions. They're doing their research, delving into the subtext of a human being. And that's kind of what I try to do, and it makes me a little nervous sometimes. So I try to do my homework as best I can. This person is an award-winning journalist and novelist. She's written two novels before the one we're going to talk about today. She's a former columnist and reporter for the Chicago Tribune. She spent a decade and a half writing about race, politics, and people whose stories are often dismissed and ignored. She served as a 2017 and 2018 juror for the Pulitzer Prize and commentary, has written commentary for the Washington Post, PBS NewsHour, CBS Sunday Morning, and a host of other places. I don't want to continue the list. But she also spoke to Barack Obama. Imagine that. She has reported from around the world, Australia, China, France, Ghana. She spent a school year as a Nieman Journalism Fellow at Harvard, and so much more. Her book titles that she wrote before, Only Twice I've Wished for Heaven. Only twice? I think I've wished a couple more times. And her other book, An Eighth of August. But this book we're talking about, Three Girls from Bronzeville. Welcome, author Dawn Turner. Good morning.
Yay, it's a pleasure. Good morning. Thank you for having me, Joy.
Oh, wow. Again, I'm honored. I'm excited. We were just having an amazing conversation right before the show started, and I think I'm just going to start with that. We were talking about how structures and physical environments affect people's mental health, physical health. You know, we think about environmental justice and pollution. All those things are connected. Dawn, how does your book deal with structures and physical environments and its impact on people's health, physical or mental?
Thank you so much again for having me, Joy. Three Girls from Bronzeville is my memoir, and it tells the story of three girls who are starting out together in a brand new apartment complex. It's the Theodore K. Lawless Gardens apartment complex in the Bronzeville neighborhood of Chicago, a very storied neighborhood. And my sister Kim, my best friend Deborah, and I were coming of age in the afterglow of the civil rights movement. And it was a moment when our parents believed that this country was finally amenable to giving us some of the advantages that it had denied generations of Black folks. And so this new, bright, shiny apartment complex was to be part of our reward. It was a 24-story building, three towers, and I mean, the janitors chased down garbage with a religious fervor. The playgrounds were bright and shiny, but we were right across the street from a public housing project named after the same Ida B. Wells, the anti-lynching activist and journalist, and we had a bird's eye view just right across the street of how the systems in the public housing project did not work the way that they did work in our apartment complex. And so it was a very stark difference. We were all the same people. We were, maybe the people across the street, maybe they were a little on average, maybe they were had a little less money, not a whole lot, but it was just a very stark difference in terms of, you know, what happens when you live in a place that's, you know, very well maintained, that's cleaned regularly, and where the elevators work. And so it's how do you comport yourself? How do you walk through the world when you live in that place compared to a place where that is suffering such decay? And that's one of the themes. It's one of that's something that I wanted to get to in the book about three girls who who start out in this place.
Yeah, another time in the book when you happen to go to college with your friend Thomas and you see the land and there, I think that's another moment also where you can see the stark difference. And when you go to your friend David's house and see where live, you know. What was your feeling about that? Tell the audience about when you saw where David lived.
Well, I think that so many kids in beleaguered communities, and this was the case back then, and I think it's true now, were there. It's a challenge to even get out of the community. And so your frame of reference is very limited in terms of what the world looks like. That wasn't the case for me growing up because with my church, we did a lot of traveling with around the country, actually, and the world.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
On the gospel tour in the summers. But just for me, seeing when I left my community to visit my friend David, he would become my husband, and just to see where he lived in a community in Chicago called Beverly, and it's a lovely place with gorgeous homes. Upper middle class, and he was at the time one of the few black families in that community. But just to see his home, I remember walking to the foyer and walking into the house and just, I was just, you know, I was amazed. And not that I had never seen a beautiful home before, but black people live there. And his father was an executive at a black insurance company, and his mother had an MSW. She worked for the Department of Children and Family Services here in Chicago, in the state, Illinois. And they were upwardly middle class. Their two older sons were in college at black universities. And David, who was my friend, I met him in high school. The first time I visited him was we were working on a project together. We were in a special program at the University of Chicago. So we went to high school at Hyde Park Academy, but we also took classes at the university as part of like this college-bound program. And that's where we met. And we were working on a project. And I was just, I could hardly work on the project because I couldn't stop looking at the house. And for a kid, it was like being in heaven, you know? And what happens when you do have these exposures, you see people who look like you, who are in places where that you can aspire to be, then that is so important to how we grow and develop as young people.
We can even take this a little further back because I hate to talk about, but since we start talking about land and structures, thinking about the idea of a home, what does home mean? And further even back, your family had actually a large home, if you will, via your grandfather. Do you want to talk to the audience about your father's father and his home?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. My grandfather, and this is a story that my father would tell me years later, my grandfather owned 160 acres in Mississippi, and he owned it in the 1920s, which was kind of unheard of. And he drove an expensive car. And at the time, there were a group of white people in the town where he was living who said, you know, you can't do this. You can't, a black man can't drive. And I think it was just a Model T. It was a Ford. But he said, you can't drive a car like this in here. And so my grandfather hired a black man to drive him around. And it was just this story about coming from a people who were able to make a way out of no way. My grandfather was very forward-thinking in his way of even, he had a group of people who were working for him, and he didn't want them to be cheated in the way that sharecroppers were during that time.
Right.
And so he wanted to do that, to have workers live in a way that was much more humane and that they were able to actually make money as opposed to, you know, at the end of their sharecropping time, you know, use their money to pay off all of these debts. So it was, and they had a number of houses on the property, but my father grew up in this beautiful home. And, you know, at a time when that was kind of unheard of. And
it was absolutely amazing.
It was unusual.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
When I read this story, when you got to that point, and I was like, what? And he got a bank loan. She's not telling you this part.
Yes.
He got a bank loan. Yes. A black man got a bank loan during the Depression.
Right.
I was just like, what did she? I had to read again. I said, wait, maybe I didn't read that correctly. Maybe he got a white person to get the loan. I was like, let me go back.
Well, I mean, the journalist in me, right, had to go back and get the deed, and I have the deed. And my my cousin, who is a judge, he's retired now. He's also a minister. He walked me through a lot of that information. He actually has done a lot of our historical, you know, ancestry type. He's gone back and done a lot of research in that regard, but he was just such a font of information and how, you know, a lot of what we have relied on as a people over the years is a combination of being incredibly savvy, being lucky, being blessed,
mm-hmm.
And just being crafty, you know, just in a very positive way. And how do we make these pieces that don't want to fit and often don't want to, how do we make them fit together in a way that we can begin to build, you know, wealth right now, but then generational wealth. That's been something that's been incredibly difficult for us.
It has. Well, you can see, I mean, that your father was telling you they had to sell off many pieces of the land. And so where's the land? Why are they not living there? Like, you know, you know,
right, right.
That's like what comes to your mind. But, you know, all the. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. I do have one cousin who has like a sliver, who has retained a sliver of the property, but a lot of the property, you're right, has been sold off.
Yeah. Now, another structure we can talk about along with story is called Three Girls. So I'm sure people are like, okay, well, they're talking about all these spaces and stuff. But another space, I mean, we're just keeping with the theme here, another space was your room when you were growing up and you grew up with a sister and you had to share a room. What are some fond memories from that room that you have you could share with the audience?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And I'll bring in Deborah and Kim at this moment. So I met my sister mm-hmm. in 1968 when I was 3 years old. And from the beginning, she was a mystery to me.
I like how you said that, Dawn.
Yeah.
I met my sister. You know? We had an appointment, and they were like, you know, now here comes
someone
the
introduced
sister.
Us.
Sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
It felt like it was an invasion. Our parents brought her home. And from the beginning, you know, it was that kind of classic story of you're the only child for a while, and then all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
there's this intruder. But she was a mystery to me from the beginning. And that was my sister Kim. But Deborah, my best friend, I met her in the second grade. And initially, she also was a mystery. And she was one of the baddest kids in the school. She was also prom queen. She was, you know, she was always getting into trouble. And I was so attracted to that because I was not getting into trouble. But she was
you
also
were a goody two-shoes.
Yes, yes. Well, or maybe a little sly. I wasn't as obvious with, but you're right. I mean, we were just these opposites. And she was also beautiful. She wore the perfect outfits and the perfect hair, matching hair ribbons. And she was stunning, even at that age. But we became best friends in the third grade. In the second grade, we were in the same class, but we were arranged according to height. And I was the tallest kid in the class, and she was the shortest. And our worlds barely touched. But in the third grade, we were arranged alphabetically, Deborah Trice across from Dawn Turner. And wow, that one logistical shift changed everything. We became best friends, and we learned we had so much in common. We had, both had one sibling, a sister. Hers was older, mine was younger. And the other thing that was just, I mean, I think fate, that we lived in that same apartment building, the same apartment complex, the same apartment building. And out of all of the 24 floors, out of all of those apartments, she happened to live in the apartment directly above mine. And her bedroom was directly above mine, which, you know,
let me tell you something,
that was fate.
Let me tell you something. It was so amazing. So many similarities. Like, I really felt like I was your sister because my best friend, we lived like above and below each other, and it was a duplex. I used to also hide under the table. You used to hide under the table, the dining room table, and that's another idea.
Yes,
of structure. Like, why were you hiding under the table, Dawn? Tell the audience what was that all about?
Well, I'll just for a second, I'll go back to the bedroom I shared a room with my sister, but I would knock on my ceiling and Deborah would knock on her floor and we would communicate across the divide. But my sister and I, we grew up in this family of storytellers. I'm certain you did as well. And so we got to hear the best stories after family gatherings. My sister and I would hide under the dining room table where the women would remain seated. The men would go off in some other place to talk, but the women would sit at the table, the women being my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt, and maybe there would be another woman. But they would sit there and reminisce or gossip, and their stories had perfect pitch in terms of timing and the way they developed characters, and those stories just came alive. And we would sit there and listen, and they would speak in coded language. So, you know, initially we didn't understand everything, but as we got older and we started to like, what? They were talking about so-and-so. And we would put those, you know, we would start to understand the dimensions of those stories, and they just came alive for us. And so as my sister and I got older and, you know, became teenagers and we just started to understand them better as well. And they were my fort, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt. The men were important. And in this story, I wanted to tell a story about black men, and I wanted them to be, you know, more than one-dimensional caricatures. But the women, they were my heart.
Well, you do talk about the men, and you talk about fathers, you talk about lovers, you talk about their history, you know, and how their history impacted you and say even Deborah, her relationship with her father. Later in the book, her father does pass away, and later in the book, though, she does say she wished her father, she was closer, and you were like, but you didn't get along with him. But, you know, all kids kind of buck up against their parents. But when you look back,
right.
I even remember thinking, you know, wow, I thought a similar thought too, because my father, unfortunately had some addiction issues and he wasn't around. And I was thinking, you know what, if he was there or stricter or more present, maybe I would have been saved from certain things because, just of his physical presence and, you know, the fear of not wanting to go against that. You know what I mean? You only go so far when with the dads. You might push the moms a little more, but the dads, you're kind of like, okay, I'm not going to push that any further. But in the book, you have a lot of lovely relationships, but a lot of them you lose. And one of the themes is death, I would say, in the book. you talk about race and fate, but death is there and renewal. Mm-hmm. How did you?
Yes.
How can you talk to the audience about your renewal after the deaths of friends and family?
Oh, I just think that it's part of, I mean, that's the part of life that we don't get to get out of, and we don't get to really change. But I think that one of the things that I've been very fortunate to have during my lifetime is just an incredibly strong family structure in terms of a network of people who I could turn to. And I think that there are a lot of kids or a lot of adults, people who don't have that. And that is so, it's something that's so necessary in terms of our ability to overcome the challenges, because we're going to have them. You know, even in lives that are just, you know, kind of charmed, we are going to have those challenges. And the way we survive them, the way that we get beyond them is to have people, to have our people, you know, who can just help us through. And when I say people, when you have your people, whoever they are, whether they're friends or their family, I'll go back to the triad, my mother, grandmother, and aunt. But my father and I had a very complex relationship, but I always knew that in a pinch, I could, you know, I could find him, and he would come through. Now he wouldn't necessarily. He missed some of the important moments in
yeah,
my life, graduation, my
yeah,
wedding.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, but when we, as I said, we had a very complicated relationship, but I always knew where to find him, even though I didn't always know how to reach him. That there is that little distinction there. But when we, years later, we would have this long conversation over several weeks and months, and I felt closer to him because of that. But as I know you know, that we, when we're dealing with whatever type of trauma it is, that the only way we are able to get beyond, to deal with it in that moment and then to get beyond it is to have people who can help us. And they provide different types of help. And that's how, you know, I did it, and that's how most people do it.
One of the things you also talk about is reconciliation.
Yes.
From tragedies. Your friend Deborah, even though you're in the same space, if we go back to that theme, growing up in the same building, she had to move away at one point, but she still had her family, and she ended up in the space of prison. And
yes.
But somehow there was reconciliation there. And
oh
that
God,
was an amazing
yeah.
thing, you know, and brought, made me think about in South Africa and reconciliation trials and
for
things of that
apartheid,
nature.
Yeah.
Apartheid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you think we can have reconciliation here in America for slavery? You see,
oh,
I mean, that
in terms of, yes. Do I think we can or we should? I think we should.
Okay.
I think especially right now we're in a moment in our country where it's so, you know, it's so riven with, we're so polarized and there's so many different subjects that separate us. But in terms of Deborah and going to prison and she went to prison for murder, and that reconciliation meeting in 2018 as you said earlier, I have interviewed a lot of different types of people, and I've sat in on a lot of conversations that are incredibly challenging. But that moment in the prison, while I was there with Deborah and her victim's family, the victim's daughter and the victim's wife, it was one of the most moving experiences of my life, because the idea of forgiveness, being able to forgive someone who has taken someone from you, forgiveness in theory works really well, but forgiveness in practice is a whole nother thing. and to sit in on that and to listen to people say, I vowed that I would not come here to say I forgive you until I meant it. And I have so much regard, such high regard for Terry Jones, the widow, and Whitney Jones, and their son, Terry's son, Jalen, the three of them who were left behind.
And the mother of the victim actually was the spearhead, I think, of the reconciliation from, like, the week after the trial almost or so. I felt like, it just seemed
pretty
fast.
Well, from the very beginning. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's
true.
So
back there in 2000. And so it was, it took nearly 20 years for Deborah to meet the other relatives. But you're absolutely right. Margaret Jones forgave Deborah immediately, and I had a conversation with her because I wrote a story about Deborah that ran right after her trial and conviction, and I wanted to get someone from the family it was an opinion piece, and I remember talking to Margaret Jones sitting at my desk in the newsroom with a framed photo of my daughter staring back at me. And I'm just sitting there trying to understand how someone could forgive the person who took her child away. And and that is, we'd like to think that we can forgive, especially depending on your religion, as a Christian. I mean, that's one of the cornerstones of Christianity. But to put it in practice again, especially when it's about your child, that's
a whole nother level.
You retain status or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know myself. I thought, I have a daughter too, and I was just thinking that's just a fear of, my daughter, but she lived in New York City for a while, and I remember when she first moved there, I was like really nervous, even though we've gone to New York a lot. So it wasn't like a over really like crazy scariness because, she knew the train
sure.
and this and that. It wasn't like that. But it was still just her, no matter where she went, just she was not in my reach, so to speak.
Of course.
So I was fearful as a parent, losing.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
We're coming close to time, so, I would love to talk to you for, another hour or two. But
yeah.
What are you doing next after this, Three Girls of Bronzeville? This is such a really awesome piece of work. It's about your life. What are you going to do next?
Oh, thank you, Joy. I am working on a novel, and I'm just going from nonfiction to fiction because I just felt like I needed a change of mental scenery, and I am so excited about my next project. I'm not quite ready to talk details, but it's enthralling. I'm in it, and I can't wait to I can't wait to introduce it to the world.
Well, I can't wait to hear about it and see it, and maybe you'll come back to talk about it. Maybe?
I'd be honored. Oh,
okay.
Oh my God. Please invite me.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm and cozy, and drink hot chocolate or tea. Thank you again for coming on the show.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Okay. All right. Talk to you later. Bye
bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. If you're just tuning in, I just spoke with author Dawn Turner, award-winning journalist and novelist. This is her third book. This is a memoir. It's called Three Girls from Bronzeville. I'll be giving away some copies, so you want to check me out on Twitter, @JoyKeys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Stay tuned. I'm going to be speaking with Bria Henderson from The Good Doctor.
Wonder if you should get tested for colorectal cancer? Well, it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., so if you're 50 or older, it's time. Screening helps find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed. Remove the polyp, prevent the cancer. Did you know there's more than one screening test? Talk to your doctor to find the one that's right for you. No more excuses, because colorectal cancer screening really does save lives. A message from HHS and CDC's Screen for Life campaign.